Herzlich willkommen zur 121. Folge des Marketing Transformation Podcast. Ganz herzlichen Dank, dass ihr in diesem Jahr so treu dabei wart. Herzlich willkommen an alle, die jetzt gerade neu dazugekommen sind. Das Jahr geht mit einem Höhepunkt zu Ende. Sir Martin Sorrell, vielen noch bekannt als der Macher der WPP, jetzt S4 Capital, sein dritter Akt, wie er im Podcast gleich sagen wird. Eine der schillerndsten Persönlichkeiten der Advertising-Szene weltweit, würde ich sagen. Hört selbst rein. Wie bereits gesagt, für mich eines der Höhepunkte. Bitte denkt dran, passt gut auf euch auf, bleibt gesund. Wir hören uns auf jeden Fall im neuen Jahr. Und jetzt viel Spaß mit Sir Martin Sorrell. Und ganz am Ende habe ich noch einen wichtigen Hinweis für euch.
Der Marketing Transformation Podcast mit Erik Siegmann.
Welcome to another edition of the Marketing Transformation Podcast. And my next guest doesn't need any further introduction. I think Sir Martin Sorrell.
So you can stop there, Eric. Don't need any introduction. We can just get on with it.
It's such a pleasure to have you on the show, Sir Martin.
Good to be with you.
I think you're one of the most iconic, or maybe the most iconic person in at least in the media agency.
You say that to everybody.
No, I this is the 121st edition of my marketing transformation, but I've never ever said that before. You can take my word.
All right. Okay.
My mother
would be very flattered.
Okay. All right. So let's get right into it. I think, like you mentioned, S4 Capital is your third act of your career. And I said you don't need any introduction. But if you would summarize the first, the second, and the third act of your career, how would you summarize it?
Well, the first was about, or backing up for a minute, my dad said, find an industry that you enjoy and then find a company within that industry you enjoy and then build a career or build a reputation. And then you fancy doing something on your own, go and do something on your own. So that was the sort of roadmap. He sort of believed sticking with one company as he did in his life was the thing to do. Maybe that, is a bit antiquarian, but anyway, or certainly against conventional wisdom now. But that was the background. So I found the advertising and marketing services industry almost by accident, frankly. I was working for an investor who'd invested in Garland Compton, which eventually acquired Saatchi's. Saatchi's reversed themselves in. And that's how I got to know the Saatchi brothers. But the first act, if you like, was around globalization. It stemmed from an article by a professor at Harvard Business School called Ted Levitt, famous marketing professor, who wrote an article in the Harvard Business Review in October of 1983. And his basic thesis was that consumers were going to consume everything in the same way everywhere. So he over-egged it to make the point. But that was his theory. And we had actually a celebration of the 20th anniversary of that article at Harvard with John Quelcher, marketing professor. And I remember John interviewed Ted, sadly, before he died. And Ted said he over-egged it to make the point. But the drift was right, which was that consumers were becoming more globalized in taste and purchasing habits not emotionally or culturally, but certainly were the similarities were more important than the differences. So that was sort of act one. Act two, WPP, was a continuation of globalization and all the benefits of globalization and free trade and the massive expansion in the world economy, driven not just by the US engine, but the Chinese engine as well. And then in towards the end of the 1990s and into the new millennium, the second great force was the growth of technology and obviously the rise of the web and the internet. And then that was Act Two. Act Two, what WPP was around globalization and technological change. And then the third act, I was going to say the final act, but the third act, who knows what's going to happen? The third act is around technology and growth. You know, at 70, well, I was 73 then when I left WPP. I thought I was too old to muck about, if I don't know how that translates into German, to muck about in slow growth or no growth activities. And I really wanted to align a business to fast growth.
Yeah.
Or faster growth. So S4 is purely about technology. So those are the sort of three acts, and they followed the growth and change in the industry. We've tried to look ahead. I mean, I think at Saatchi's, we looked ahead towards globalization, the impact of that. At WPP, we did that, the rise of the BRICS and the next 11, as they were called, and the rise of technology. Maybe didn't do enough in both areas. You know, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, you always wish you'd done more and you were too conservative. And then with S4, we've been very aggressive on the growth side, and we've gone from a standing start to, you know, a £3.25 billion company in 3 years. So I think, you know, with what, well over 7,000 people in 33 countries. So the technological change has been as violent as anything.
I'm quite impressed by your third act, but probably it's going to be, I don't know whether it's going to be your opus magnum, but hopefully not the final act. But let me, and I'm going to have many questions regarding S4 Capital and its structure. But when I first discovered that there is such a thing as a media holding company, I was quite impressed.
Yeah, you keep on using the word media holding, and we should call it really advertising and marketing services. So I really, there are four addressable markets that we really target. Advertising and marketing services covers it all, but it's the media market, which is about $750 billion, both traditional and digital. And the digital piece is growing this year at about 30%, the traditional about 10. This is in the pandemic rebound overall, up about 20%. Then you have the marketing services, which is about $550 billion, probably growing at around this year about 10 or 15%. Then you have trade budgets, which Amazon really targets, around $800 billion, $850 billion, $900 billion. And then digital transformation services, around $400 billion, depends on whose stats you favor. And all those markets now have at least 50%, in the case of digital transformation, obviously more, at least 50% of their activity is driven by digital. Digital in media crossed 50%. I think it was last year. This year probably got up to about 55, 60%. In fact, some of the holding groups, you know, the holding groups are in a difficult position because their media companies say the market is growing at this year, let's say 15 or 20%, more like 20%, with digital up 30 and traditional up 10 on the fiscal and monetary rebound, and yet the holding companies are only growing around 10%. So that seems to tell you that the holding companies are losing share. So it's quite a difficult thing for them to come to terms with. But that's the market in which we operate in. It's about a $2.4 trillion market. It's growing, driven by digital, at probably the longer term growth rate is around 10, 15, 20%, depending which segment you're looking at, as against traditional media, which continue to be under pressure. So coming back to using the term media holding, it's probably the wrong term in my view. We probably should call it the advertising and marketing services business.
You're absolutely right, but I think the misunderstanding is that I wasn't referring to the presence and to S4 Capital. I was still a little bit two steps behind you at the former WPP world, and those well something I'm referring to the late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay.
And from my point of view at this time, these kind of holdings, actually the party was especially taking place in the media business, where media agencies are buying and selling media inventory for advertisers, to put it on.
Yes and no. I mean, I think you're right in the sense that, you know, we consolidated at WPP. If you remember, Mindshare was the creation of the Ogilvy and JWT media departments. Chris Jones, I think it was at the time, was running JWT. Shelley Lazarus was running Ogilvy, and the media departments got squeezed by the independents. You know, a lot of people like the Groh brothers, like Michael Casson and his partner originally in the first independent, what was it called, Western Media, I think it was called, in first independent in America, Chris Ingram at CIA. They created these independent media units, and they focused and specialized on media. And the traditional agencies were forced, kicking and screaming, actually, to try and consolidate their media operations. That's where Mindshare started. That's where Group M started. And that's where you saw Omnicom do the same thing, and Publicis do the same thing, and Dentsu. And they started to focus and split the creative part of the business from the media part of the business. And you're right, that began to grow heavily in the late 80s. And into the 90s. And then that was, but it's changed now, because those, in those days, brawn, muscle was really important.
Yeah.
Today, it's about brain in a 24/7 always on world.
Yeah.
Where, you know, buying media in a nanosecond, you know, it brain rather than brawn. The other thing that happened was around about 2015-16, clients became very concerned about transparency.
Mm-hmm.
Either rightly or wrongly, nothing was proven with all the kerfuffle. Again, I don't know how that translates into German, but all the controversy around transparency. But, you know, for example, S4, we built through Mighty Hive, which is now part of Media Monks, we've built a transparent model which doesn't rely on discounts and rebates in any form whatsoever. So it's a very different approach to what was it. But you're right. I mean, media became very important in the late part of the last millennium, as we came into the new millennium. But it shifted again with the rise of digital.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting perspective. From my point of view, it was rather the decline of something like television, and the obvious gaining importance of digital point of contact throughout the entire industry. I think direct to consumer advertisers started to adopt these new paradigm a little faster, and probably FMCG advertisers a little later. But what's stuck me till today is how slowly the advertising industry really changed.
I could be very direct, Eric, and say clients have been slow to change too. I mean, without naming names,
you could.
We'll come on to verticals and categories, but I think just like the agencies, the tradition, you know, all analog companies, to be fair, it's very difficult to change.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the biggest issue. I remember Hubert Joly, Frenchman, who moved from the hospitality industry to Best Buy in Minneapolis. I remember him giving a talk where he said, ex-McKinsey consultant, if I remember rightly, has written a very good book recently, saying about digital transformation change, saying that, you know, when he went to Best Buy, and it was a little bit of a surprise that he ended up there, but he did a brilliant job. When he went to Best Buy, everybody said to him it was all about change management. And he spent 6 months looking at everything. And Best Buy have done very well, I think, in terms of digital transformation. He spent 6 months looking at it. And at the end of 6 months, he came to the conclusion it was about change management, and he changed the management. So he changed all the people, all his direct reports. And I think, you know, in that story, that one story, you have the essential issue that in order to get the change that you're talking about, particularly at the beginning of the new millennium and into it, you really had to make very significant change. It was very difficult for analog companies. You know, the average life of a CEO in a listed company is about 5 years, I think. Yep. The average life of a CMO is much shorter. It might be two and a half years. The average life of a company now, according to McKinsey, an S&P 500 or a FTSE 100 would be, let's say, 13 years or whatever it is. So change is very rapid. And I think to answer your question head on, you know, 50% of S4's revenues, which this year will probably be around about $900 million, 50% of those revenues come from tech companies. Four out of our six biggest clients that we talk about whoppers. These are not big in the context of the industry. Yeah. These are companies that we do about $20 million of gross revenues or more a year. Four out of six are tech companies. When I look at the other 19 that we've identified that we think could become whoppers, making a total of 25, well over half are tech companies. So they are digital companies, to your point. They are new media companies. And it's much easier to start, like I did 3 years ago, with a clean sheet of paper. Yeah. You know, the good news is you have a clean sheet of paper and no history or no albatross to sort of drag you down. The bad news is you don't have the scale. But of course, if you grow the business, you get the scale.
Yeah. You've been growing your business since 2018 extremely fast. I think you became unicorn, pound unicorn within a yeah. year. And you did that mainly, via mergers and acquisitions.
That's a bit unfair. Because whilst the mergers were going on, you know, in Germany and elsewhere, the organic growth rate, you know, yeah. last year during COVID, the organic growth rate, so exclude mergers, was 20%. This year, first 9 months, it's been 47%. And the previous year, you know, if you went back to 2019, it was 40%. So we've grown violently, organically, but you're right. I mean, we started with nothing. We started with, you know, I'm sitting in the office where we started. We started with one person in one room with an idea on a piece of paper. So it was from the beginning. But again, I mean, coming back, you know, our mission is to create the new model, the new advertising and marketing services model. And our mission is to disrupt the traditional model, because the traditional models didn't start at Saatchi's or at WPP or Omnicom or Publicis. It started in the 1950s with a man called Marion Harper at IPG. That's where it all started. And we think that is no longer fit for purpose. We think different structure. And we have four principles around S4. The first is we're just in digital, because mm-hmm. that's where the growth is, as I explained. Secondly, it's a data-driven model. So data driving the creation, production, distribution of content through digital media in a continuous loop. So it's not a fixed, you know, we don't go with iconic and emblematic campaigns, which are finely tuned over 3 or 4 months. You know, we try and create the content with the big idea at its heart. So big ideas are still critically important to what we do, but they're executed in a totally different way. We make the product, we make the content, we create it using data, which I know is anathema. You know, it's scandalous sometimes in our industry to suggest that data might drive creativity or improve creativity. And I think it does. And it gives, you know, the example I always use is that David Ogilvy, it is true, you know, he sold Arga cookers before he started Ogilvy at the age of 40, but he also was an employee of Gallup, and he understood how important data was in terms of informing creativity. So our model is what I call the Holy Trinity model of data driving the creation of content and distributing it through digital media in a continuous loop. So rather like an election campaign, rather like the recent German election campaign for the Chancellor, where you continually adjust your creative output depending on the data and the reaction that you get from consumers. So that's the second thing. Thirdly, we go to market as faster, better, cheaper. Agility being key. Understand better means understanding the digital ecosystem, and cheaper probably a bad word, but focusing on efficiency. Mm-hmm. Yeah, even in a world where there's inflation like there is now, there hasn't been for many years, efficiency is really needed as clients want to. So focusing on that. And then the fourth principle is around a unitary structure. We believe in a single P&L, not verticals, silos that prevent you from progressing. And the biggest problem that the holding companies have, and to some extent, I think the consulting companies, but probably less so, is the verticality of their operations, which prevent them from working together effectively.
Yeah, I do get the idea, and I'm totally with you, the importance of data. The world where I come from, it's a given, and I'm not coming from the creation part of things. You consider yourself as a service company or a holding for service company, not a tech company, is that right?
We're not a holding company. We are one brand. I mean, it's true. So let's go through the history. So in 2018, yeah, in May, you know, what is still our largest sort of merger, I merged a private company with Media Monks, a global content creation, production and distribution company. And then, so that created our content practice.
Yeah.
And then in December of 18, Mighty Hive, which was a leading company based in San Francisco. Media Monks was based in Amsterdam. Again, global, but based in San Francisco around data and analytics and digital media. And we brought the two together. And then, so we had the two practices, one in content, one in data and analytics and digital media. And then we added about 13 companies to the content side of the business, Media Monks, and about 12 to the data analytics and digital media, and we've now created one brand. We merged the two together. I would have liked to have had the name Mighty Monks, but my colleagues prevailed, and we're Media Monks. We have a single operating brand, and we operate as one. Remember that fourth principle that I mentioned, yeah, unitary structure, one P&L. That's critically important. So we operate as one. So we give our clients, the theory is we give our clients access to well over, it's about 7,250 people now in 33 countries who are digital specialists, digital natives. You know, they're it's not even digital first, it's they're part of their DNA.
Yeah, right. And my understanding is that you're of course you're extremely specialized on the digital area, that doesn't mean that you don't have proprietary tech solutions. Your MediaMarks is one of the biggest vendor of the Google marketing solution, isn't that right?
Well, what we do is we agnostically analyze. When I talk about faster, better, cheaper,
yeah,
faster is about agility, which I think is the key corporate attribute. Better is about understanding the digital ecosystem. So I should take a few seconds, describe who that is. It's Google, mm-hmm, it's Facebook, it's Amazon, it's Tencent, it's Alibaba, and it's TikTok. TikTok is the only one really to break through. This year, Google will do, remember what I said, the media market's about 650, 700, 750 billion. Of that 700, 750 billion, call it, 215 this year at least will be Google, I think. Facebook will be about 115. Amazon will be 35. The only one to really break through of the platforms is TikTok, which is around 32 last year. I don't know what it's done this year. True, most of it's from China. Alibaba and Tencent, we can't estimate accurately what they represent in terms of spend, but those are the dominant platforms. So the six platforms. Then you have Apple and Microsoft. Apple approaching $3 trillion in terms of market cap. Microsoft, $2 trillion. The two most valuable companies on the planet, I think maybe with the exception of Saudi Aramco. So them, and then the big software companies or other software companies like Oracle, Salesforce, and Adobe, then IBM and SAP, Twitter, Snap, Pinterest, LG, Samsung, just one thing, Twitter and Snap are both around 5.5 billion of spend. So remember what I said, the numbers were for Google, et cetera. They dominate. Google, Facebook, Amazon, Tencent, Alibaba, and TikTok dominate at 30 billion plus a year, as opposed to what I said, five and a half for Twitter and Snap this year. They're important, don't get me wrong, but in terms of scale, much less so. Then you go to, as I said, LG and Samsung, Shopify, Spotify, Netflix, JD.com, Xiaomi, Epic with its Fortnite games technology around the Unreal Engine. All these things are really important. So we look at all these companies and any other ones, you know, Kaohsiu or Didi or whatever that come in. We look at all these companies and we try and assess the relative merits of all of them, where their strengths and weaknesses are. So we agnostically make sure that we understand where the shifts are coming from. So we're part of the service layer. We don't want to have technological risk. I mean, when we look at a company as a merger partner, we look as to whether they buy into our mission of creating the new model and disrupting the old. But at the same time, we're really interested in four things: top line growth, decent margins, no susceptibility or limited susceptibility to technological change. We don't want to be disintermediated by that technological change. So we're part of the service layer. And then finally, management has to have a very strong shareholding interest, because we believe that owner-led companies are better than manager-led companies, where there is a clear identification of common interests between management and owners. We think that's critically important.
Is it true that if you're looking to acquire a company, it is the common practice that the founders are rolling over something like 50% of the shares to
ask
for capital?
Yes. All our deals have been done on a 50-50 basis with lockups. So what we're asking for is people to commit. You know, what we say, the very first sentence of any conversation we have is, if you want to sell your company, we're not the people you should talk to. You should go and talk to Accenture or whoever it happens to be. And Accenture do, you know, a very good job of buying these companies and assimilating them into their platform. It's like a machine. Yeah. But we're not looking for that. We're looking for one, as I say, I go back to the fundamental principle. We're looking for people who want to build the new model and disrupt the old.
Yeah, I do get the idea of a common P&L. I do understand the manager versus founder paradigm. What is your perception, especially on the German market, regarding how well received is your concept? Because it's still new. Of course, Accenture has been here. They did acquiring Sina Schrader over here, and Kollerbe on the creative part was the probably the first move of Accenture in your field, to say so. How happy are you with the reception on the German market of your company? Well, you won BMW Mini. That's what I do remember on the German market. Yeah. But what else?
You know, Gorillas, Allianz. I mean, we've done well. We've done well. Mm-hmm. And, from a small beginnings, and we've merged obviously with Staud as well, and they've become an integral part of MediaMonks. No, it's gone well, better than we anticipated. But coming back to what you said, Accenture Interactive and Accenture are a formidable force. But you know, we've recruited from Accenture Interactive. I remember talking to somebody who were recruited from AI, if I can call them that, and they are separate verticals. I mean, we saw that in the pitches for Mondelez, which we also won, where they competed. And we saw that when they competed for BMW. And they do an awful lot of work for BMW. It's a big client of theirs. So they're very strong, but it doesn't mean they're unbeatable. And what they have is these, you referred to Sina Schrader and Kohlrebi, but the Monkeys or Karma Rama or, you know, King James. I mean, they have these pools of talent. But what is what is the purpose of it? I mean, Accenture and Interactive, I don't know how many deals they've done. They've done 41. I think it was a very shrewd move by Julie Sweet to replace, who's the CEO of Accenture, to replace Brian Whipple, who was running Accenture Interactive, with David Droger. David Droger is a creative force. But if I could be so bold, his skill, I don't think, is in, you know, consolidating 41 different brands. I don't think, well, I don't know, maybe he's changed, but from what I remember, that wasn't what he was interested in or his great skill. I mean, he's a great iconic creative figure, but is he really interested in consolidating all these companies? The answer to your question, Eric, is the new model, the trade between the companies that you bring in and the S4 or whoever it is not the old trade. The old trade at a WPP or an Omnicom or a Publicis or an IPG or a Dentsu or Havas, the trade was you retain your autonomy and your independence and we'll do the back office. Our trade is different. You merge your company into ours. We use the word merge, not acquisition. And you become part of Media.Monks, which is our operating brand. And you become part of that. And you get four things out of it. One is access to clients, because we don't have every client in the world, but we have a considerable number. We can't get in front of necessarily every client in the world, but you know, our people are very effective presenters and pitchers, particularly on a land and expand basis. We don't like the big 12-month long pitches. We're not keen on that because we have limited resources and we don't want that to be sort of sucked away. But what we're really interested in doing is building our business with our clients. So one thing is client access to clients. Second is access to geography. We're in 33 countries. We have, as I said, 7,250 digital specialists. You get access. So if you're a private company being very successful in Germany or France or Italy or Spain or China or whatever it is, and you want to expand your footprint, we're an ideal platform, if you like, to do it. So the second area is geography. Access to talent. We have those 7,000 plus people, so access to talent. You can blend your talent with our talent. And then access to capital. We don't have unlimited sources of capital, but we're capitalized at £3.25 billion, about $4.5 billion. That's after 3 years, and we have access to capital. So that's the trade. That's a very different model to the old one. I think in Accenture's case, you know, you basically have to make the decision that you want to sell your company because you're going to become part of a giant machine with 650,000 people, probably get. You know, most of the people I talk to think they will go to 1 million people. Their market cap is about 230 billion. They've done extraordinarily well. When you think that was a split off from Arthur Andersen, you know, you think about Deloitte's. They probably have a similarly sized business in Deloitte's, which is part of the audit practice. With Andersen, they made the decision to split it into two. So, which was, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, a very shrewd decision. But it's very siloed and very fragmented and very different to our model.
Yeah, I do get your strategy also in, I do get the attractiveness for founders being a merged part of your new entity. I'm still hesitating how the reception of advertisers are, but since we're starting from the beginning, that all the rotten things happening in old agency businesses, transparency issues.
Did you say rotten things?
Yes, I did.
Okay. All right.
Things are aren't right. We still have a large. I mean, we have conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Contrast of interest, well, transparency issues. The decline, the obvious, you mentioned it all the time, the obvious decline of the old agency models is quite obvious. It's not a hidden information anymore. It's quite happening.
Be fair, you use the word rotten, which is a strong word. I don't know whether...
Well, that's because I'm German and my English isn't good enough. Not ideal. Probably is that more British?
Well,
not as it should be.
No, to be fair, and you know, I was WPP when that sort of started to, and we saw it with the ANA in America. We saw those investigations, and to be fair, there was a lot of noise, but nothing. You know, with the exception of Havas, who I think admitted publicly, if I remember rightly, on the front page of Ad Age, that they made an administrative mistake in relation to various transactions in Europe. I think it was in Spain or France or whatever. With that exception, nothing has been proven. There's been a lot of sort of scurrilous, rotten talk, but not been proven, to be fair. But you're right, it wasn't a transparent model. And there is a shift in the marketplace. So the response, you asked about the response, the response has been strong. I mean, we wouldn't be growing at 47% this year in the first 9 months of the year against a market which is up 30%, unless we were getting considerable traction for a model which was digital only, which was data driven, was faster, better, cheaper, more efficient, and which was unitary. So the answer to your question is the reception is strong, and the concerns about the traditional model remain. Now, we'll see, you know, there are pitches where clients consolidate their business. You know, we've seen that recently with Coca-Cola, for example. But very interestingly, I think the Coca-Cola decision was a very shrewd one for Coca-Cola because they have access to three of the big groups, WPP, IPG, and Publicis. Pepsi use Omnicom. There is a conflict issue in the minds of the Coca-Cola and Pepsi executives, which often precludes companies from working, even with different brands, working for both. And they've kept a third of the roster available for independents like ourselves. You know, if you look at their announcement, so shrewdly, they've ended up accessing three of the big holding companies and being able to retain relationships with independents too. So we'll see how that shakes out. But generally, I think clients, you know, the things I think that clients really want, they want agility. They want the ability to take back control. I think what happened after the great financial crisis was that clients devolved too much. I mean, I'm using take back control, which was the Brexit tagline, Dominic Cummings wrote but take back control and then first party data. I mean, it's those three things to me: agility, you know, getting on with it in a 24/7 always on world. You have to be literally there or thereabouts all the time. One thing. Secondly. Taking back control because you outsource too much. So we have three models. We have the outsource model. We have an embedded model where we work on clients' premises, like we do for Google, which you mentioned before. And then thirdly, we do in-housing. I mean, you know, our in-housing for Sprint and now for T-Mobile, its new parent, our in-housing for them is subject of a Harvard Business School case study. So, you know, we very quickly established these different models. So I think that's the second area, taking back control. And then the third one is the use of first-party data, which with Google's decision around third-party cookies, with Apple's decision around IDFA, controlling, developing, consented to get over the privacy problem, consumer data, and using that to create content at scale, personalization at scale, distribute it through the system, get the reactions, and then moderate. I mean, I still think the Netflix model, which is, I think, probably the best example that I've seen so far of personalization at scale, is the model for a lot of what we do.
Yeah. What is your biggest limitation in terms of top line growth? Because my next question would have been, what's your biggest competitor? Like, is it Deloitte, Accenture, or is it in-housing? And you answered that explicitly. So if that isn't a limitation, because you're also helping advertisers on the insource or taking control, back control,
yeah,
or gaining control in general, what is your biggest limitation in terms of top line growth?
Well, you know, we discuss this all the time. We try and get a balance between top line growth and margin.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one thing that that's why we like landing and expanding. If I looked at our top six clients, you know, Google has basically been around land and expand.
Mm-hmm.
It's true we have merged with companies that had Google as a client, but broadly, the majority of that expansion has come from land, what we call land expand. So we win a project, we do a good job, we get another project.
Less dependent from pitches, isn't that right?
Yes, and then the second biggest client, we don't give the name, but people can guess who it is. It's one of the major fangs. Again, that's been pure land and expand. The third one, BMW Mini, and then Mondelez, with roughly the same size, both by pitches. Fifth, Facebook, land and expand. We have added Facebook capability through a merger. And then HP is the sixth. And, you know, you asked about how do we get traction. Well, last year we had two whoppers. This year we have six. We've identified another 19. HP is a great example. We started less than 3 years ago from zero, and we built a big relationship for us there. In the context of HE's business, it's not huge yet. We built it purely by land and expand. So that's what we're trying to do. And I think the reception of the model is very strong because it is so different. On competition, there are three levels. There is sort of the specialists, like an Oliver or a Jellyfish. Then you move up to another level, where you have the bits of the holding companies, the AKQAs or the VMLs or the Huge or RGA, those. And then there is there are some independents as well, like Wieden and Kennedy, who I think are pretty strong. And then you get to the consulting level, where it's Accenture Interactive broadly. I think that's the key competition. And of course, we've now, Eric, gone into technology services with the addition of Zemoga, a Colombian-based offshoring, nearshoring technology services company. We've opened up that fourth addressable market that I mentioned at the beginning around technological services, tech services, which is about a $400 billion market growing at about 15-20%. And the competitors there are Accenture Interactive, Globant, which would go head-to-head with Accenture too, EPAV, Indava, Perficient, ThoughtWorks, C&IT, a Brazilian company that's just gone public. So that's broadly the competitive set. I mean, in this conversation, you focused a lot on Accenture Interactive. There are a lot of people trying to eat their lunch.
Yeah, I do get it. I think the reason why I'm referring to Interactive is because I'm concentrating on the German market, and it first happened here. And you're mentioning them publicly quite often. What I could find. that's why.
Well,
that's obvious.
They're super impressive, and but they are huge, and of course. You know, it's a bit like the analogy between a motor torpedo boat and an aircraft carrier.
I like that picture. If we would imagine like having the same conversation 5 years from here now, we've been talking about the strategic consultancies like the BCGs and the McKinseys of this world. They do happen to have a specialized digital practice, and they're getting a little bit more operational. Is that something Not heavily.
Okay. I mean, they are not as executional. I mean, mm-hmm. historically, you know, the lead partner at Bain was on the board of WPP, Orit Gadish, And Bain would say they did things more operationally. I'm not sure I buy that. I think the consultants tend to be driven by presentation, PowerPoint, young MBAs, not necessarily with deep experience. And there is some frustration about that. But, they are a force strategically. I think, whether it be McKinsey is a force. Actually, funnily enough, McKinsey introduced me first to MediaMonks many years ago. So, I would say McKinsey, Bain, BCG, all these companies have capabilities. They tend to be more strategic and less executional. And we have 7,000 people. A company like Globant has 20,000 people plus. Accenture, I mentioned, has 650,000 people. Some of these companies that you're referring to are body shops, where, put it crudely, where it's a question of the number of people in the organization determines where you're going. So it varies. But I would say that's pretty much the competitive set. I don't see the consultancies really, we work with them rather than against them. Mm-hmm. And we tend to complement them. So they might recommend a strategic direction for a client. It might be around in-housing. A couple of examples of that recently. And we pitch for those opportunities and implement. So I don't see them. I see the competitive, the specialists, the bits of the holding companies, and then the consulting companies. Let me call them the practical consultants. The implementational consultants.
I get it. Isn't the landscape of practical implementation consultants and the in-housing trend, isn't that putting some pressure on your overall margin, at least at the mid and long-term perspective?
I don't think so. I think the basic difference is between when you win big pitches, which tend to be procurement and finance dominated.
Yeah.
And what I would call land and expand, where you do great work, you build a relationship, a productive relationship. I was talking to a client last Friday, and she feels that her company, it's a FMCG company, she's the CMO there, she feels that they've not done enough digitally. She doesn't like the idea of going through a big competitive process. Any CMO knows who are the agencies that their organization can work with. And I think it's much better to say, look, here's an opportunity. It might be a biggest problem that you have, the client has. Why don't you take a look at this and show me what you can do to improve things? Or to answer the problem or answer the question. So I think that's what we have to do.
Excellent. I could continue the discussion with you for much longer, but we
so in your 121 previous podcasts or whatever it was, what are the big issues that you think the clients worry about?
Very good. It really depends on whom you're talking with. Since I come from the e-commerce or direct-to-consumer industry, it's about tech. It's about if we're talking about bigger advertisers, it's about accountability, capabilities, and transparency. And of course, growth versus costs. Well, we're all living in an auction-based environment now. And I think the biggest issue my partners do have is that with scale comes a different, with scale doesn't come a cost reduction, it comes together with a cost increase, and CLVs are customer lifetime values are rather diluted by limitation of loyalty, and that's the biggest issue the organizations are facing. So it's all about tech capabilities, skills, and how to deal with the better with this customer acquisition costs.
Do you think the clients think enough about their own structures?
For sure not. I think in my podcast we're highlighting it because I'm quite convinced that the biggest root cause for all these problems we have is because the organizational setup, but also to track, to steer, how to really do that lifetime cycle from acquisition to lifetime value, that this is a huge issue, especially for legacy companies who are older than 10 or 20 years. A company like Gorillas, for instance, of course, it's a totally different game because they've been born something like 2 years ago. But if you are a traditional German mid-sized FMCG company, you have quite an important dilemma.
Why do you think they don't change sufficiently, or they find it difficult to? Does it go back to the Hubert Jolly story I gave you about? It's about change management.
I have two camps. Yeah, exactly. It changes. It's the, of course, it's innovator's dilemma in its pure meaning of the word. But I can differentiate the two camps, and it's totally linked to the shareholder situation. I have camp equity owners who are aware of the challenges, and I have rather anonymous capital where, like you mentioned it before, where the duration of the contract is more important than the mid or long term well-being of the employer. And that's the biggest. I can see it. I told you I also run a professional service company, and my best clients tend to be private equity companies because they are asking better questions. And okay, what can we do for the next 3 or 5 years in order to make that company more valuable? And they don't ask me how I could pimp up my P&L for the next 2 quarters. So, and that is.
Private equity companies take a long enough view? I mean, you say 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, compared to other situations, yeah, 3 to 5 years. Not only private equity companies, also some family offices where you have the occasion to really to directly discuss with the shareholder. I think 3 to 5 years, depending on the question you're asking. If you need to optimize the product market fit, of course, 3 years is quite small. But if you're talking about agency pitches, tech questions, yeah, or organizational setup questions, like you remember that differentiation between communication and performance marketing budgets, that is still happening even in the year 2021, and that's something you can get rid of in the next 2 or 3 years if you want to get rid of it.
Yeah,
okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. But I think a lot of it is to do with structure as well. I think the tech companies, the reason that we do so well with tech companies is their structures are much more fluid. You remember what I said about agility?
Yes, sure.
Being the key corporate attribute. And I think the tech companies, because they haven't had time, you know, they don't have the history and the legacy, and they haven't had time, maybe in a few years' time they will, to build, let's say, bad habits. But I don't mean bad habits, but you know what I mean, structural habits. And there's a lot of fear about change and a lot about a fear of the impact of change, that it will disturb the status quo. And that's why actually the pandemic has accelerated digital transformation at the consumer level, at the media level, and at the enterprise level, because there was such a Q2 of 2020 was such a disaster that you had to get on with it. There was no reason not to. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think we would agree that liabilities in organizational setup, also tech debt or whatever, but even you don't need to blame it on tech. It's always easy to blame anything on tech. It's rather organizational legacy. Sure. Which is preventing these kinds of company to adopt it much, much faster. But
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Very good.
Great.
I hope that was okay.
It was really great. My last question is there anything you regret in the last 2 years of having done or having not done, or what is your worst decision?
Last 2 years.
Yeah, or you can time-wise go back as far as you want.
I think you always, you know, you see things happening, and you might see the right things happening, but you never move fast enough. You never move fast enough. I mean, you could always do more, and you could always do it better. But you know, if you see a direction that you think, that doesn't mean we're right all the time. Obviously, we make terrible mistakes. But I think the biggest problem, and this is for a company that's only 3 years old, while it was 30 or 300 years old. But the biggest problem is you don't move quick enough.
Yeah.
And you know, trying to manage a business, and I do it with basically 12 other people, us trying to manage the business at this level of growth, you know, it's hugely interesting and stimulating and motivating. But you know, you really want to do even more. And I think, you know, the biggest thing is what we touched on at the end, actually, is that, you know, we want to work with clients that really are committed to change, and getting commitment to change throughout the organization. You know, CEOs often talk about agility, for example, and they say their organizations are agile. And then when you start dealing with the organization, that's far from the truth. You know, if you continue to budget and plan around verticals, you get vertical behavior. If you plan, or you know, that's why the unitary structure in our case, I think, is so important, because at least in theory and in practice, it brings people together, because we're not sitting there spending minutes and hours and days and weeks and months figuring out where the revenues and the profits are. What we're trying to do is increase the whole. And it really, to us, the organic growth rate is the key issue. And so if I have any regrets, it is that we didn't move even faster.
All right. Very impressive coming from you. but thank you so much. It was one of my highlights of the week, I would say. It's Monday now, of the 120 podcasts I've done.
All right.
Hope all the best. Thanks for your time.
All right. And very good.
Talking to you soon. All right.
Okay. God bless.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
So, das war die letzte Folge für das Jahr 2021. Ein besonderes Jahr, würde ich sagen. Ich wünsche euch großartige Feiertage und einen guten Rutsch. Bleibt gesund und passt gut aufeinander auf. Und zum Abschluss nochmal ein Hinweis in eigener Sache. Wir vergrößern unser Team bei Digital Forward und suchen aktuell noch jede Menge schlaue Menschen, die uns bei unserer Tätigkeit unterstützen können. Online-Marketing-Consultants zum Beispiel im SEA oder im Displayer-Schwerpunkt. Aber noch viele andere Stellen mehr. Guckt also bitte bei digitalforward.de auf die Jobseite. Wir haben da die Möglichkeit, gemeinsam für unsere Kunden, namhafte Kunden, sehr, sehr wertstiftende Marketing-Audits gemeinsam zu machen. Die Aufgaben sind vielseitig, die Projekte sind herausfordernd, aber super spannend, also digitalforward.de oder gerne auch auf der LinkedIn- und Xing-Seite von Digital Forward. Ich freue mich auf eure Bewerbungen und auch ganz nebenbei die ganzen Paper und Bücher, auf die Sir Martin Sorrell hingewiesen hat, die findet ihr auch auf meiner LinkedIn-Seite zu diesem Post. Nochmal, alles Gute, passt gut auf euch auf.
Dieser Podcast wird produziert von Podstars bei OMR.